you know, we often think of fingerprints as this print that you can, you know, look at and, you know, identify a perpetrator based on how it looks. But analytical technology is getting so sophisticated that you can, in the very microscopic deposition of sweat, like a fingerprint has a very small amount of sweat in it. In that sweat, you can identify all sorts of, you know, dark things.
Welcome to Science for the People. I'm Bethany Brookshire, a freelance science journalist. And like every good podcaster, I am currently recording this episode in a tiny, cloth-walled room otherwise known as my closet. The clothing and quilts and sound baffles mean I get a really nice density of sound. There's no weird echo. But it also means that I'm sweating like a pig. It's hot in here. And I feel gross about it. Sweat is a perfectly normal bodily function, and I feel gross. Why is that? Why is sweating a source of shame? And what amazing things could our sweat teach us? Here to read the sweat stains for us is Sarah Everts. Sarah is a science journalist and professor at Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. She's written for Scientific American, Smithsonian, New Scientist, and The Economist, and she holds a master's degree in chemistry. And like me, she sweats a lot. Which is why she wrote a book on it, The Joy of Sweat, The Strange Science of Perspiration. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So first, sweat is one of those things that almost everyone does, but it's also something that seems a bit oddly ignored. When you ask someone, for example, to like name bodily functions or fluids, you'll think of peeing and pooping and vomiting and pretty much everything else all the way down to hiccups before you think of sweat. Why does sweat slide under the radar so much, do you think?
It's so perplexing to me because it's effectively one of the things that makes us human. But I think it has to do with the fact that we spend so much money trying to pretend that sweat and its stinky consequences don't actually exist. Like the antiperspirant and deodorant industry is, you know, $75 billion strong. And I think part of it is, you know, we're spending this money to hide our sweat. And so we're kind of continuing on with that facade, perhaps.
It's funny because, you know, when I think of poop, for example, because we're talking about sweat, we might as well talk about poop.
Absolutely.
Think of like poo-pourri and like the tushy ads for bidets. You know, we're really open about the poo, but we're not so open about sweat. It seems oddly taboo, even for us.
Yeah, it's really fascinating because that taboo, that stigma is really old. I mean, you go as far back as, you know, ancient Rome, and people are talking about, you know, stink as this embarrassing thing. Like I have on my wall this quote from Catullus, the poet. I don't know if you mind if I read it,
but
I sort of love it. It's sort of my humorous inspiration. So it's this letter where he's writing his friend and then nemesis, this guy Rufus, and he says, "Wonder not, Rufus, why none of the opposite sex wishes to place her dainty thighs beneath you, not even if you undermine her virtue with gifts of choice silk or the enticement of a pellucid gem. You are being hurt by an ugly rumor which asserts that beneath your armpits dwells a ferocious goat. This they fear, and no wonder, for it's a right rank beast that no pretty girl will go to bed with. So either get rid of this painful affront to the nostrils or cease to wonder why the ladies flee." And so, like, I mean, even in ancient Rome, people are like, you know, agonizing over their BO. I mean, at the time, you know, they solve it with soap and a heck of a lot of perfume. But yeah, this is something that, you know, we worry about. And, you know, even, you know, centuries ago when Charles Dickens writes David Copperfield, he makes one of his, you know, one of the bad guys, the villains, Uriah Heep in the book, he gives him hyperhidrosis. This is this like, you know, problem of excessively sweating, and, you know, presents him in this kind of really stigmatized way, where he stigmatizes sweat by saying that, you know, Uriah, when he like touches a piece of paper, leaves a sweat track that looks like a snail track. You know, it's people like to point out this thing in that we do that's like fundamental to being human in this negative light.
I think it's proof that humans will stigmatize basically anything.
Absolutely.
So you wrote an entire book on sweat.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, you know, what got you into it? Was it Catullus? I mean, I would totally get into it because of Catullus personally, but was it Catullus? Was it your own sweaty self? Like, what really made you be like, you know, there's a book in sweat?
That's really funny. There's sort of like a couple of things that all kind of happened simultaneously that made me think, okay, I need to do this. You know, one was I got this, you know, science journalists, right? You get a million press releases in your inbox. And this one day I get this press release, and generally you don't actually open the emails, you just press delete. But the subject line is artificial perspiration. And it was like, you know, advertising some new product. And I was like, wait, what? I sweat enough that, like, why would you need to create artificial sweat or synthetic sweat? I mean, really? And so, you know, I opened it and discovered that there's like this whole industry of, you know, bottles of fake perspiration, you know, being sent around the globe. And I was like, that's fascinating. And, you know, meanwhile, I really like to hike. And, you know, I noticed that, and I've always noticed that, you know, I'm the first person in my group of hiking buddies to start sweating. I'm the one who like pulls off their, you know, shirt or their jacket and strips down to my sports bra and shorts after like just like three steps. And so, you know, I'd always felt like I sweat a lot, and I kind of frankly got tired of feeling embarrassed about it. And I was like, I think I need to learn a little bit more about it. And then, you know, last but not least, I moved to Germany for about a decade. And while I was in Germany, you whenever you move to a new place as an expat, you kind of want to get to know locals, do the thing that they do. And what Germans do is they go to the sauna. And in fact, they go to the sauna a lot. And so I started to do that too. And at first it was just kind of like very hard for me to conceptualize. I was like, I would prefer not to sweat. Why would I go and do this as a pleasurable hobby in my spare time? And then I realized, wow, there's this really amazing catharsis to sweating. And, you know, wouldn't it be better if we all, you know, enjoyed and you know, found joy in sweat instead of being always so, you know, embarrassed about it?
And of course, you discovered sweat theater, or, well, sauna theater, which is my new favorite thing. I got to see it.
Oh, yes. It's called Aufguss Theater. And so one of the things that Germans do, and actually this is spread all over Europe, is this thing called Aufguss, where you are in a really hot sauna and you go and you pour water on the rocks, which is a pretty standard thing. And, you know, is also done in Finland. But what kind of distinguishes Aufguss is that there's the scented oil in the water that you pour on the rocks. And so you get this like pulse of steam in the sauna that is also, you know, really beautifully smelling. And so you're kind of hit by this beautiful pulse of fragrant hot air. And then this is where it gets weird. So then the Aufguss master pulls out a towel and starts whipping it around so that you get like hot gusts of this fragrant air on you. It really, really makes you sweat. You just start to pour. It opens your floodgates. And it's actually kind of a challenge sometimes to like stay in the sauna for the entire ceremony. And oh my God, you do not want to have Teutonic side eye, because if you stand up and can't handle the heat during this Aufguss ceremony, they will glare at you as you like sneak out. So you withstand it. But The next like level of awesomeness and or weirdness is this thing called Aufgusstheater, where that person who's flipping around the towel is not only whipping hot air around thanks to the towel, but they're doing towel tricks. So they're like throwing the towel in the air at like a pizza, like you would do with a pizza, and like doing all sorts of like fancy dance moves. And by the way, there's music. And sometimes there's costumes and video projections and special effects. And in fact, like there is an Aufgusstheater World Championship where people perform in like 13 minutes a small play in the sauna, dancing around with towels and costumes while, you know, hundreds of people sit naked watching. And it is surreal and wonderful.
I want to do it so bad.
It's great. This is like what I miss most from like pre-pandemic times.
So before we get into kind of the biology and the culture of sweat aside from the sauna theater, I do want to note to the listeners that we did do an episode on the evolution of sweat and why it is that our sweat stinks. It's episode 526, and not only is it awesome and sweaty, it actually includes Yana Kamborov, who Sarah yes. interviewed for her book. So you should absolutely check it out.
She is so great.
Now, so most people know that sweat helps us cool down. But one of the amazing things about your book is that we learn it is not the only option. And of course, yes, there's panting, and panting is probably fine. But there are animals have so many other amazing options to cool down. And by comparison, sweating is practically delicate. And I was wondering if you could talk about some of the animals, especially the vultures, which are my new favorite party piece of inspiration, which is why I never get invited to parties.
And neither do I. That's what happens when you write a book about the science of sweat. Okay, so yeah, animals are, when you know what animals use to cool down, it makes sweat look really beautiful in comparison. So effectively, sweat works because it's evaporating water off our bodies, right? And it's whisking the heat off our skin away into the atmosphere. But if you are not a human and don't have millions of sweat glands embedded in your own skin, you have to rely on other bodily fluids, which if you think about other bodily fluids, those include vomit, saliva, pee, poo. And so vultures cool down by pooping on their legs, and their poop is pretty liquid, and so it evaporates off and cools down their legs, which cools down the blood circulating nearby. Seals, for example, will pee on themselves and let that evaporate off. Honeybees will vomit on themselves and let that evaporate off to cool down. And, you know, they're doing this because death by heat stroke is an appalling way to die. It's really not good. And evaporative cooling, this evaporation of water off your body, is really one of the most efficient ways to cool down. And humans, as I said, like we have millions of these little machines to do this in our own body. And it can do it also really carefully, right? If you think about peeing or pooping or vomiting, it's hard to like release just the right amount without releasing too much or too little, right? So like sweating, we can, you know, sweat consistently and start and stop. When you're cooling down with these other bodily fluids, you kind of like purge, and then you have to like really, really rehydrate before you have enough to do that again. So yeah, sweating is not only way less gross than what other animals are doing sometimes, it's also super efficient.
And, you know, when you think about the seals that pee on themselves and the bees that vomit on themselves. Oh, and the best part about that is that other bees then go and lick it up because you don't yes. want to waste that good vomit. You know, by comparison, sweating is positively dainty.
It is. It's beautiful. I mean, think about like a subway in the middle of summer, right? Imagine if we weren't all just sweating in there. Imagine if we were like peeing, puking, and licking ourselves to coolness. Sweating is like perfection in comparison.
I was just going to say, I mean, you're talking about people doing, you know, peeing and vomiting and whatever in the subway. I'm just going to say you haven't been on the DC Metro.
Yes, that does happen. But imagine if we all had to do it.
So one of the things I found really fascinating about sweat is that this is a natural bodily function. But we've always been embarrassed. And what's fascinating to me about this is that usually we're not super embarrassed by the fact that we do sweat. We tend to be really humiliated by the smell, right? And covering it with perfumes and stuff. But what I love is that nobody ever really seemed to think this was a problem that needed like actual product solving until the past 100 years or so. And I was wondering if you could talk about kind of the evolution of deodorant and where that really came from.
Yeah, it's kind of really, it's really interesting because, of course, you know, about 100 years ago is when the first deodorants and antiperspirants become widely adopted. And I use widely adopted, not invented, because they were, started getting invented, in the late 1800s, but nobody wants to buy them. First of all, it's the Victorian era, and nobody wants to talk about any bodily fluids, sweat included. But also, people just don't really think that they need these products. They've been doing fine with soap and water and a little perfume. Thank you very much. And so, the first deodorant and antiperspirant entrepreneurs really have to convince the population, the public, that sweating is a problem and that deodorants and antiperspirants are a solution to this problem. And even that is really tricky. So in the book, I talk about this one product, Odor Oh No, which I love, like Odor Oh No, which is actually an antiperspirant. And it's invented actually by a Cincinnati doctor who's not really worried about his armpit sweat, but he is worried about his hands because when he's doing operations in the summer, he's worried about his knives, I guess, slipping. So he doesn't want to have sweaty hands in the summer. Now, he has a daughter and her name is Edna Murphy, and she thinks, this stops hand sweating. Let's try it in my armpits. And effectively, she decides to create this product, Odor Oh No, that goes on to actually be the breakthrough product for deodorants and antiperspirants. It's not the first to be invented, but the difference is that she hires a brilliant marketing manager, a guy named James Webb, who effectively instills the fear of stink in America.
And particularly in America's women.
Yeah. And so I think, so what his advertising does is he supersizes the fear and anxiety people feel about sweat. So, as I mentioned before, it's not like humans haven't stigmatized sweat over millennia. We have. But we haven't, it wasn't until about 100 years that we kind of, this turned into, not just a kind of an annoying, possibly normal aspect of real life to this thing that we all need to worry about with intensity. And so, for example, the issue of body odor or say halitosis isn't new. Folks have complained about it, throughout history. There's this great anecdote in Catherine Ashenberg's book, The Dirt on Clean, about how medieval priests may have used incense to survive the stink of so many unwashed people crammed into a church because, in the medieval era, nobody even wanted to wash because they feared that that increased your risk for catching the plague. But you know, when deodorants and antiperspirants take off in the early 20th century, it's because advertisers create enormous social anxiety about body odor. They present deodorant and antiperspirant as a solution to an embarrassing medical ailment, right? And this only works if your potential clients think that they have a problem or that they have an ailment. And, you know, up until this point, you know, everybody knew that, you know, there's body odor and sweat, but, you know, they have perfume, they have incense, they have soap and water. And so they don't really think, you know, that they need something more than that. And so Edna Murphy hires this this copywriter at J. Walter Thompson, the company, and they do this fascinating survey around 1919 that finds that many women know that deodorant and antiperspirants exist, and they know what they're aimed at doing, what they're for, but a majority of those women, at the time at least, didn't think that they had an odor problem. They just didn't think it was an issue. And so that's when these marketers realize that they need to not just inform people about, you know, what deodorants and antiperspirants do, they need to actually put the fear of stink in women. And so they use this strategy called whisper copy to do so. So to women, they say, hey, ladies, if you smell, A, nobody's going to tell you to your face, but they'll gossip behind your back about it. And B, ultimately, this BO is going to kibosh any plans you have for finding love or marriage. And I think, you know, part of the thing that I find so dark about it, the really dark part, is this evilly brilliant part that nobody's going to tell you, right? That you can't trust your own nose. You can't trust anyone or anything except our product, right?
So diabolical. I just, yeah. I hate him. I'm sorry. How could you? It's become really a time-honored tradition just in advertising, especially targeting women, to create a problem and say, hey, here's a thing you never knew you should be embarrassed about. And now you should.
I know.
See, for example, the birth of the razor and shaving your legs, which was also completely made up.
Yeah. What's really fascinating to me is that these first deodorants and antiperspirants are, you know, marketed to women, right? Because women are not allowed to smell, even though, you know, body odor is, you know, this macho, amazing thing that makes you a manly man. And what's really fascinating is, so these early marketing strategies that put the fear of stink in women, they're extremely successful. And eventually, though, they hit market saturation with women. They've got all the women terrified and buying these products, and they still, though, want to make a buck. And so they're thinking, how do we expand our market? Oh, there's all these men who also stink, right? But they've kind of shot themselves in the foot by presenting deodorants and antiperspirants as this very feminine thing. And so they have to kind of do these, like, bend over backwards to try and make deodorants and antiperspirants a macho thing, so that, you know, they can get twice the amount of money from the male market. And what's kind of interesting is that they strategize on solving this problem in two ways. One, they think, you know, what is, you know, a major insecurity for men? And, you know, at the time this was happening in the 30s, you know, there's been this stock market crash. You know, joblessness is a huge issue. And so they're like, okay, let's put the fear of no job in men as the way to get them to buy deodorants. And so a lot of the early marketing strategies for deodorants and antiperspirants for men are like, don't stink in the boardroom or in the office, because if you do, it's going to compromise your job. And meanwhile, they have to, like, make these products look super manly. And so, like, some of the early deodorants and antiperspirants are doing things like selling deodorants in, like, a whiskey jug, which you're just like, okay.
I would buy one.
I love whiskey, and
especially if my deodorant also smelled like whiskey. Companies, have you considered getting on that?
Well, Old Spice is kind of like going there, but my secret online buying addiction is two. I buy kind of old advertisements online, the paper copies, and then also I buy online old deodorant bottles because why not?
That's brilliant. I mean, you could also, expand your habit into buying all the weird new deodorant scents that they're coming out with. Like, I definitely saw one the other day that was Yeti scented. As in, like, you too can smell like a Yeti.
Well, I have to admit that I do actually buy another thing online related to body odor, but it's actually these really, it's snake oil. I buy pheromone cologne online, like the stuff that's like a guaranteed to nab you a woman. Typically it's targeted at like white male, white cis dudes who just want to spritz something on a lady and have her like follow him home.
50% of the time, it works 100% of the time.
It's amazing. and they have like all this pseudoscience promises, and it's a wormhole if you disappear into the YouTube promo for this stuff. But yeah, I've purchased quite a number for this like kind of pheromone boar project stunt art installation thing that actually got cut from the book. But yeah, I can tell you about it if you'd like.
Well, I do want to talk a little bit about pheromones actually while we're there, because one of the cool things about sweat that I learned from this book is that, yes, people are embarrassed and they probably don't need to be. Oh my God, chill out. Is that sweat contains information. The stink of our sweat, well, first of all, the stink of our sweat is, in a way, bacterial poo, because it's not our sweat itself that stinks. It's the bacteria break down the sweat, and it's the byproducts of the bacterial digestion that actually produce the smell. So it's kind of bacterial poop that is smelling in your armpits, which I love.
Yes.
But there's also so much information in that. And you note that we actually identify people by smell. We, babies identify their caretakers by smell. Parents identify their babies by smell. And you actually cite research noting that the rest of us continue to do this through our lives. And this really startled me because I've never noticed anyone talking about identifying someone through their smell. And I was wondering, is this also kind of a taboo kind of topic, that smell can be someone's kind of signature?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting, right? Even siblings who haven't seen each other in several years can identify the body odor of a brother or a sister. And, we have, in our minds nostalgia about the smell of maybe our grandmother's house, or, the smell of, spring or whatever. But definitely how people smell is something that we definitely are aware of and take note of. But it's really interesting because, that cocktail of odor molecules that, distinguishes your pong from my pong, could perhaps be attractive to, somebody we were romantically involved with. And that is often what people think when they think of pheromones, right? They think, I love him, her, them because of their smell. But what's interesting is that when you know what the strict definition of a pheromone is, that doesn't seem to make sense.
Right? I was going to ask, what are pheromones supposed to be? Because they aren't the part of the smell that you smell.
So, by the way, like I should caution that, like, the strict definition of a pheromone is, like, if you ever want to get a bunch of scientists in, you know, a knockdown dragout fight, it's like to ask them to define that. But, like, effectively, typically, you know, a pheromone, at least a sex pheromone, is released by one member of a species, and it consistently has an effect on another member of the species. So let me give you the example of bombacol, which was like the first pheromone described. So if a female silkworm moth wants to find love, she releases this odor, bombacol, and literally all the males in the region will make a beeline towards her, right? And so it's working on all the men, and all the females make this molecule. There's nothing like, there's not like a unique odor print to that particular silkworm moth. And another example, pigs. So a male will produce androstenol and androstenone in his saliva. And when he breathes heavily on a female in heat, she will spin around and lift her hind legs, which is sort of like a message that she is ready to start a family. Like, she effectively gets into position. And this works on all females in estrus, like who are ready to mate, all the time, or most of the time. And so this idea of a pheromone is this molecule or molecules that, you know, has this very potent and reproducible effect. And that's really inconsistent with what pop culture likes to present pheromones, right? People like to present it as the thing that distinguishes me to my one and only, right? It's the thing that made me fall in love with him or her and not that other person. And that's really inconsistent with what actually a pheromone is, you know, according to, you know, the scientists who study these things.
And it also gives me the terrible vision of a bunch of desperate guys in bars breathing in women's faces. And please never do that. That
When you think about, right, what a pheromone actually is, like a sex pheromone, then it's terrifying to think that we might actually perhaps one day find a human sex pheromone, because, like, what kind of awful power would that molecule possess?
That is deeply ethically fraught. Yeah.
Oh, right. And scientists have been searching, though, for years, because, of course, right, we have these two kinds of sweat glands. We have the sweat glands that produce the salty stuff that helps us cool down. And then we have the apocrine glands, the ones that appear in armpits at puberty, and that sweat is like waxy. And that's the sweat that gets eaten by microbes and turns into the majority of our body odor. And because it appears at puberty, you know, scientists think, well, it's got to have something to do with sexual maturation. So why would we produce this smell at puberty if it wasn't somehow involved in mating? And so, you know, many researchers have looked impotently in the armpit for, you know, chemicals that are pheromones. And, you know, they've come up with like all sorts of contenders, but there's been nothing that has been, you know, conclusively shown that, you know, this molecule comes out of an armpit and it is a sex pheromone. And here it is. And look at what it exactly does.
I do wonder why they keep looking for pheromones when there's so many things that come out of our armpits that we can smell. So why not look at those? Right? Because one of the interesting things about pheromones is that often they're supposed to be kind of scentless. They're sensed via a different organ, like the vomeronasal organ, things like that. There's supposed to be this idea that pheromones are somehow chemically different. But I mean, there's plenty of smells that humans produce that we can smell perfectly well.
Right. So you're kind of alluding to this issue of consciously smelling and reacting to something, or unconsciously smelling and reacting to something, or consciously smelling something but unconsciously reacting to it.
Right.
And yeah, it's super complex. And, you know, what's interesting is, like, obviously we consciously smell the body odor of the people we love and are closest to. We can't help it. And we have these conscious reactions. We're like, oh yeah, that's my brother or my grandma. But there's all these, like, unconscious signals that scientists are determining are coming from our body odor. And it's not only just related to sex. So, you know, we often use the word pheromone, and it has all this sexual baggage. But, you know, when scientists study this stuff, they call it chemo signals, because these signals, maybe they don't have this, you know, crazy response that, you know, those pheromones that I described to you have, but perhaps they have these subtle impacts on our behavior. And so, for example, researchers have done really interesting studies on illness. And what they did was they took a bunch of healthy people and they effectively injected them with a component of a bacteria that would kind of prime their immune system, that would get their immune system busting up and, you know, get it ramping up. And then they, you know, took they took body odor samples from these people who didn't show signs of sickness, but who had immune systems that were on overdrive in response to what they thought might be a pathogen. And when they, you know, gave this to women to smell, women in particular, you know, kind of like were repulsed by it, were they were repelled by it, even though, you know, there was no outward sign of sickness in these people. And so, you know, that it's like this tantalizing suggestion that perhaps, you know, in the body odor, in that cocktail of molecules that's going up off of our bodies and being detected by our nose, either consciously or unconsciously, some part of that is giving cues that, you know, we might be sick, which of course would be important information to know for human evolution. You know, for most of human history, the biggest threat to us has been, you know, infectious disease. So we would want to avoid somebody who is sick. And, you know, another molecule that's not sex related, but is really interesting, or is, you know, this idea of trying to find an anxiety molecule in our sweat.
The smell of fear.
The smell of fear, right. Because law enforcement have long said that, you know, when they do interrogations of people, you know, people come in smelling like themselves, but everybody leaves smelling the same way, in this kind of stinky anxiety way. And, you know, researchers have also done studies where people can identify when others are fearful. But again, no molecule has been plucked out, even though there's a lot of organizations that are super interested in trying to figure out, you know, what molecule might be responsible for the smell of fear. The military, for example, because you can imagine that if you have a bunch of soldiers in a tank and, you know, somebody gets super scared, that, you know, what if this fear is catching? And so, you know, they'd ideally want to find a way to capture and sequester, you know, the anxiety fear so that, you know, people could stay focused and not get scared themselves. And, you know, more diabolically and alarmingly, you know, there's also the potential that, you know, if you could identify a molecule that was responsible for the smell of fear, right, for communicating, hey, I'm really afraid, that you could perhaps use this as some sort of weapon, right? You could spray it on crowds of demonstrators, right? To, you know, take away, you know, to make them afraid of demonstrating, or, you know, on enemy populations. There's so many kind of alarmingly dark potential applications of this, in addition to the kind of interesting idea that, wow, you know, maybe we're communicating that we're afraid to one another through smells in our body odor.
Yeah. And, you know, it's really fascinating because in reading this book, yeah, my mind went to those dark places. Like, yeah. Wow, we could use sweat and smell, body smell in scary ways. And you also talk about how, for example, many people don't realize this, but your fingerprints are made of sweat. And people can analyze that sweat to find, you know, drugs that you've done or crimes you've committed, you know, things like that, medicines maybe you've taken. And I was wondering, you know, did you talk to someone who works in ethics about this? Because it seems like there's a lot of potential to really misuse our sweat in ethically questionable ways.
Oh, absolutely. I tried many times. I reached out to many bioethicists and I kept getting responses like, whoa, don't know about this. Yeah, not my bailiwick. And so that actually made me even more alarmed because I was like, why are there not researchers out there, you know, thinking about this? And, you know, in their defense, this technology is very new. So effectively, as you said, you know, our fingerprints are just actually sweat prints. It's a mix of that like salty sweat that we produce to cool down. And then also sometimes like sebum, which is kind of like the oily stuff your skin produces to keep you, you know, hydrated or, you know, to keep you having soft skin. Anyway, you know, we often think of fingerprints as this this print that you can, you know, look at and, you know, identify, you know, a perpetrator based on how it looks. But analytical technology is getting so sophisticated that you can, in the very microscopic like deposition of sweat, like a fingerprint has a very small amount of sweat in it. In that sweat, you can identify all sorts of, you know, dark things, right? So I actually had my sweat fingerprints taken by a researcher who's awesome in Sheffield. Effectively, we watched caffeine appear in my sweat. So we did it early in the morning, which was like very traumatic for me because I usually am completely incompetent without coffee. And she was like, listen, you're going to have to come to my lab without coffee. And then they took some of my sweat fingerprints and there was no caffeine signal in it. And then, you know, I got to drink a coffee and, you know, 15 minutes later, there it is appearing in my sweat. It's like 15 to 30 minutes it takes usually. But, you know, this sort of research, this sort of analysis, this chemical analysis of fingerprints is different from the, you know, visual analysis. And you can discover all sorts of things like biomarkers for cancer, you know, evidence of illegal drugs. So if I had drunk, if I had put a little whiskey in my coffee in the morning and or snorted a line of cocaine on the side for a morning pick-me-up, all of that would have appeared also in my fingerprint marks. And so you can imagine in the same way that, you know, surreptitious collection of DNA is, you know, contentious to ethicists, what if law enforcement could start taking surreptitiously our fingerprints, lifting them from all the things that we touch, and then determining, you know, what we've been imbibing? And not only law enforcement, what if this happened at work? What if this happened, you know, in, you know, places like, you know, the courtroom, say, if you were a parent trying to get custody of your child, or, you know, there's all these sorts of ways where you can imagine chemical analysis of fingerprints getting very private secrets into the public sphere. And so that I find very alarming. And I really wish this was something that, you know, an academic thinker trained in bioethics would really take on.
I mean, maybe now they will. Maybe,
I hope so.
Maybe some of them are listening. but I did want to get back to kind of smell and sex because, like, our minds are in the gutter, right? Like, that's where we're going.
Yeah.
Anyway, and we know, for example, that some humans are attracted to other humans' body odors, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, people, different people are attracted to different smells. And so you actually looked into this yourself because you went smell dating. And I love that this is a thing. And I was wondering if you could talk about what smell dating is supposed to do.
Right. Okay. So the premise is that, you know, yes, certainly, as you allude to, you know, I may, you know, really enjoy the smell of my lover. But even if that's not my fetish or your fetish, at some point you are going to smell the body odor of your lover, and it's pretty much going to be a make or break moment. And so the premise of smell dating is a little bit like, you know, we might as well cut to the chase, because if you don't like this person's body odor, this is not going to work out. So it skips to the kind of most critical moment, or one of them, in, you know, whether a relationship is going to work or not. But in practice, it's really, really fun. So this is how it works. I was actually in Moscow for one of these smell dating events, but they happen all over the world. I've heard of them happening in Rio de Janeiro, in New York City, in Berlin. But the one I went to was in Moscow. And it happened in a park on a sunny afternoon, and you show up, and the first thing that you're supposed to do is to wipe off with kind of like a little, what do you call them?
The things towelette. That we all,
thank you, a moist towelette, an odor-free moist towelette. You take off any kind of product that you're wearing that has smell. So perfume. You also are instructed to wipe down your armpits. You make a clean slate. And then you start doing calisthenics. So we were like taken through a round of burpees and like jump squats and, you know, things like that to work up a sweat. And then you're handed this cotton pad. So like a dry little pad, and you're supposed to dab yourself down, particularly in your armpit area. And then you go to the organizers, and they have this glass jar that's numbered, and you put your little cotton pad in the glass jar, and you remember your number. And the numbered glass jars are placed on a table, and everybody is invited to sniff them. There's no distinguishing for gender preferences or anything. It's a free-for-all, which I loved. And you just go through and sniff around, and you pick your top five. And of the top five, you give those numbers to the organizers, and you hope that somebody else has picked your number two. And if there's a match where I pick your number and you pick mine, in Moscow, at least, you would get this like VIP bracelet to this all you can drink vodka cocktail lounge. And you could go with your match to, you know, see if the personality and the looks also worked and not just the smell. Anyway, I did this, and oh my gosh, it was so interesting because some of those jars are really not great to my nose, right? Like, who knows? Maybe mine was really not great to some people. But, you know, some of them were just like really pleasant odors. Like, it wasn't even like, it's like you identify it as like, oh yeah, that's another human. And it kind of, it's nice. It's not, you know, it doesn't, you know, turn me into like a horny pig, or like, you know, I'm thinking of those like pheromone examples I was giving you. It doesn't make you crazy, but they're just like pleasant. And then there was actually one odor that I smelled that I was like, whoa, now that is hot. And it didn't like drive me crazy, but I was like, wow, this is very reminiscent of sex. And it reminds me that sex is a really nice thing. And I can't even explain that. So I certainly put that number down. I got matched with somebody, not with that person, but with like the person who kind of reminded me of like a grassy field. It was really fun to kind of get to know her. She was a really cool person.
What I found really fascinating actually about your smell dating story in the book is that most of the people doing the smell dating didn't seem to actually be looking for a date. Like, They seemed, it seemed more that they were interested in doing it just kind of for science, like you were doing. And I was wondering, did you find anyone in the smell dating? Did anyone actually end up getting a date?
Right. So, what's really, so you're, those are like two interesting separate questions, and I will answer both of them. So there was all sorts of couplings that came out of this exercise, some of which were like really hilariously never going to happen. But I did encounter at the VIP lounge this like totally sweet, gangly guy with this, young woman who, and they were like really goofy. Like I swung by to chat with them, and he's like, "We're both students," as if like that was a match made in heaven. So that was sweet. And like, there was some serious romantic chemistry there. And I really liked that. I also interviewed this other guy who, so the organizers did, I think, maybe three or four separate rounds of this smell dating thing. And he told me that he kept doing them again and again, trying to like match with somebody. And aww, like the only time he ended up matching with anybody, he matched with this other guy. He's a straight guy. He went to the VIP lounge with that guy because he was like, "This guy seems really nice, and we both want free vodka cocktails." But he was like, he told me he was like really bummed out that, you know, aww, he never ended up getting matched with, you know, somebody that it could ultimately work out. So, you know, I think, you know, of course the sample size is small, right? Like I think there was maybe 30 or 40 people doing this. Mm-hmm. You'd probably to do this with true scientific rigor, you'd need, you know, a lot more individuals.
Yeah. So I was noticing, you know, the more books I read, and I read many science books partially for this show, and the more I work on my own book, which, hey guys, I'm writing a book. So that was that one. Yay. Anyway, the more I realize that there's so much that goes into a book that never makes it into the book. For every book that you end up reading, every science book, it's like the tip of an iceberg, and there's this huge mass underneath of stories that just didn't quite fit, you know, didn't quite make it in. And so for every book, there are just fantastic stories that get cut because they didn't quite fit. And so I was wondering, what got cut from the sweat book? Was there any amazing story that kind of slipped through your sweaty fingers, as the as one might say?
There are like two that I'm sort of bereft didn't make it into the book. The first is I actually got my sweat glands counted by this awesome scientist named Andrew Best. And hilariously, to get your sweat glands counted, you need dental polymer and mild electrocution. So he was like, "You need to know that this is involved." I'm like, "Sign me up."
For the sake of science.
Yes, exactly. So effectively, the way you always see this number in dermatology textbooks that humans have between like 2 and 5 million sweat glands. And sometimes like the low end of that is like 1.5 million. And the way that this is determined is, it was like determined like decades ago using cadaver skin, where, you know, researchers take representative swaths in different parts of a cadaver's body and figure out, you know, using histology, you know, they stain the skin and you can see the sweat glands, and they do a count. And because, you know, different people have different densities of sweat glands in different parts of their body, they kind of figure out representative, you know, densities of sweat glands, and then they do kind of an overall estimation. But that count is of, you know, just sweat glands writ large. There's no evidence that they're actually functional, right? So to actually figure out, you know, how many functional sweat glands you have, you need to kind of catch them in the act. And that's what Andrew Best is doing for a really interesting research project that he's working on. And he kindly offered to like help me count my sweat glands. And so effectively, to catch sweat glands like in the act, he takes dental polymer. So that's that putty that if you ever have been fitted for braces or a retainer, this is the thing that they use to take the impression of your jaw and your teeth. And it's a very, very soft polymer. And so what he does is he like makes kind of like a little pancake about the size of a fist and uses that, places it on top of your skin, and effectively takes an impression of your sweat glands pushing sweat out, right? So all the little sweat droplets push and make a small little impression. It looks like, you know, stars on a starry sky, except in dental polymer. The thing is, though, is he needs your sweat glands to be in like full-on berserk mode. And the way that he does that is he uses a drug called pilocarpine. And pilocarpine is like this, it opens the floodgates. It's like on and like you start to sweat. And what they do is it's in this kind of gel that you put over your skin, and he uses like mild electrocution, a mild current to push the drug into your skin topically. So first you have like the drug, and then he quickly removes the gel, cleans you off, and slaps on this dental polymer. Slaps on is perhaps he gently applies the dental polymer, and your sweat glands that have all gotten the like let's go are in full berserk mode, and they like after just a few seconds they push. The sweat glands are pushing little droplets, and they're making little impressions. And so that's how you get a count of your actual active sweat glands. And, you know, he does this in representative places over the body. And then you can figure out, kind of do a total body estimation. And as it turns out, I have 3 million sweat glands. We've known each other long enough for me to share this very personal information.
Oh, thank you. So you're like slightly above average, you think?
I'm actually kind of smack dab in the middle, right? Like 2 to 5 or 1.5 to 5. But, you know, as I had mentioned to you, like I was actually pretty surprised. I'm like, hey, I always thought I was I sweated, you know, on the higher side of the continuum. And, you know, he made the interesting point that, of course, it's not just how many sweat glands you have. It's, of course, like the flux, right? Like, so, you know, you can do more with less if you're just like pumping out a lot of sweat, right?
Yeah, I mean, so some of them just might be very good at their jobs.
Yeah, exactly. And mine are just exceptional at their jobs, you know.
Well, and I know that there are some studies, this wasn't in your book, but there are some studies that show that, for example, athletes and people who work out a lot or people who kind of live in hot environments may sweat sooner.
That was in my book. So effectively, you know, this idea that there are, you know, people who don't sweat, you know, that those people that I personally am jealous of, it's actually very unlikely that they're not sweating. Like we are all sweating unless you have a genetic condition, and that's extremely rare.
And that you do not want.
That you do not want. Yeah, it's horrible. You can't control your body temperature, right? But most of us are sweating at all times. And the people who, you know, in hot weather don't appear to be sweating at all while, you know, the rest of us are like, you know, have like drips pouring off our body. Those people are just like extremely efficient sweaters. So their sweat glands are very attuned to releasing exactly the right amount for the temperature cooling required, right? So that's actually kind of a pretty amazing feat, because if you imagine that, you know, really wasteful sweaters like me, I sweat a lot in the hot weather, you need to actually rehydrate. You need to drink to replenish. Whereas people who are, you know, not appearing to sweat at all are, you know, obviously doing it extremely efficiently. They also need to hydrate, but they're not as wasteful. But yeah, your point about, you know, athletes is totally true, right? So people who have, who who effectively do high levels of sport, right? If you are an athlete, you need to sweat to cool down. And your body has learned that, oh crap, when, you know, that Olympic runner sprints, they are going to need to cool down pretty fast. And so often people who train often start sweating sooner because their bodies have learned that, wow, a little bit of activity usually means a lot of activity, and we're going to need to like get cracking on the like temperature control.
That's what I feel that my body does. Is that I start walking and my body's like, we've trained for this moment.
Yes, exactly. It's really interesting because when I also started going to the sauna more, I started to sweat sooner and faster too. And I'm
like, trained.
Really? Yeah, exactly. Because my body's like, oh my God, she's going into that extremely hot room for a very long time. Got to get cracking.
So basically we don't necessarily want fewer sweat glands. We want sweat glands that are a little less klutzy.
Yes. Efficiency.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for being here. Even though I have to say, I sweated bullets the whole time. This was fantastic.
It's really my pleasure. I sweat all the time. So yeah, I was sweating too.
And if you'd like to learn more about Sarah Everts, we've got links on our website, scienceforthepeople.ca. And if it's your first time and you like what you hear, please do subscribe to the show. Maybe follow us on Twitter or Facebook so you never miss us. And if you are up for it, we've got links on our site to our Patreon page where you can help us keep the podcast going. We truly appreciate your support. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time on Science for the People.
Science for the People is listener supported. You can find us on Patreon, where you can support us with monthly donations in any amount. Your support keeps us afloat and able to keep making great new episodes, and we thank you for it. The show is produced by Rochelle Saunders and edited by Ryan Bromsgrove. We get help with special projects from K.O. Myers. Our theme song was written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. The show is hosted by Bethany Brookshire, Anika Hazra, Marion Kilgour, and me, Rochelle Saunders.